This is When Orla Met, a conversation with and about some of the leading athletes, engaging brains and fascinating characters in sport. I've been wanting to chat to this episode's guest since I started this podcast. I first met him in the years building up to London 2012. And from the outside, at least, Johnny Peacock has always seemed to me to be a bullet train of positivity through this often difficult world. And he seems to bring huge success his way because of that. The 100-meter runner suffered a life-threatening episode of meningitis when he was just five, which led to his right leg being amputated. Today, he is a double Paralympic and world champion and has been one of the rare athletes to cross over to mainstream consciousness with a stint on Strictly Come Dancing or Dancing with the Stars, depending on where you live, and countless TV and media appearances before and since. It's his determination and attitude, though, that have always struck me. And I wanted to find out more about what can create such a seemingly upbeat attitude to life, given what could have been such a difficult child and early adulthood. This is When Orla Met Johnny Peacock. So, Johnny, here we are in the bowels of the London Stadium, taking refuge from the heat. It's a swelteringly hot day. We're both here because of the Athletics World Cup, which we're working on. Thank you for taking time out of your prep. It's been a busy couple of days. But athletics has been your life, I think it's fair to say. Take me back to the very beginning. How did you get into sport, especially given your start in life and maybe as a kid or certainly as a parent, you might think that sport might not necessarily be for you?
Yeah, I think for me, I never gave my parents that option. Yeah, I think it was sport absolutely all the way through. You know, I think even when I was a kid, just running around, you know, the second that I was given a leg to run on, I would be going crazy on it, you know, running away from my mum too many times. You know, she probably wouldn't enjoy the chases. And then, yeah, when I started school, every sport that I touched, I loved, you know, especially football. Football was the big one for me. But growing up through secondary school, I picked sport as subjects in GCSE. I really just did as much sport as I possibly could, really. I absolutely loved it. So yeah, I never let my leg or anything really hold me back. It was my passion, you know. I just loved being active. And then I was really lucky that I went to my prosthetist, the place where I get my legs made, and there was a poster on the wall and it said, you know, are you good at sport, aged between 14 and I think it was 24 or something. And I was 15 at the time, and I asked her, I said, oh, what's this poster about? And she said, oh, we've actually got these talent days running at the moment. One's in London, Mile End, which is obviously only about a mile away from where we are right now, basically giving different sports a go and seeing if you're any good at it. So I went down to one of these, got a day off school, which was great. It's an extra bonus. And I gave my hand at wheelchair tennis, pistol shooting, and sprinting. They had a little 60-meter sprint timing gates laid out. And I think I did three runs in the end, and I because I didn't like my first one. And then they told me at that point, they're like, yeah, you're not going to get any faster now, because I think I was obviously getting slower at this point. But yeah, I got picked up from that. They obviously liked my time, and it really snowballed from there, really. They British Athletics caught on, set me up with a local coach, and yeah, I started training, and yeah, I guess that kind of kept getting faster and faster until before I knew it, I was in this stadium 2 years later.
So what was that like as a kid? Do you have any memory of feeling different? It's quite remarkable to think that you were just running around on your prosthetic leg and playing football. Did it never strike you that you were different and that there was something that could literally be holding you back?
No, I definitely never saw it as holding me back. You know, I think the only thing that I really saw was maybe a negative was the fact that, you know, obviously sometimes kids can be mean, so they bully you a little bit. It wasn't too bad in primary school because all the kids kind of saw what I went through, so they were very understanding. It was very kind of, I guess, normal to them because they'd seen me from the age of five and they'd grown up with me. But then when I moved,
younger kids are so much more open, aren't they?
They are, yeah. I think kids are great. They're so honest as well, and they just seem to take everything that you throw at them. I think kids are incredible. But then we moved away. We moved to a different school, so I didn't stay with these kids. And yeah, so suddenly I was, to these new kids' perspective, some strange kid that's just come in with a funky disability that they've probably never seen before. So I guess, look, it is normal for kids to kind of wonder. They're inquisitive, you know, they want to probably know what's going on, but at the same time, you know, I'm different, they're seeing me as somebody different, and kids, it's an easy target, I guess. So yeah, there was a few times where you kind of bullied. It never was severe, you know, it never was crazy. I know that I'm quite lucky. A lot of kids get bullied today, so very lucky that it never got to that extreme. But no, I never really let it hold me back. You know, I just loved getting involved, and if anything, probably tried to use it as an asset. Like, things in rugby, no one wanted to tackle me, so it's great. No one wants to break their shoulder on your leg, do they? So yeah, they just let you run down the wing. No, you have him. No, thanks. Yeah, just let him go. We'll take the game. Yeah.
So for anyone who hasn't read your story, then remind us how you lost your leg and how that all happened.
So when I was 5, I contracted meningitis. Meningococcal septicemia is the long name for it, which is a type of blood poisoning, basically. I was very ill overnight, kind of vomiting, just looked like I was just severely ill, really. My mum went to call the doctor in the morning because it hadn't subsided. And by the time that she'd gone down to get the phone and come back upstairs, I was covered head to toe in a rash. And I think at that point she knew it was meningitis because of the fact that everyone now knows and associates the rash with meningitis. I was rushed into A&E, put into a coma within minutes, and they had pumped me through, I think, pretty much everything they could do. The doctor turned to my mum and said, right, we've done everything we can, now it's up to him, you know. So it wasn't looking good in the early stages. They warned my parents that there was a high chance that they probably wouldn't be taking me home because it was so severe at that point. Luckily, I think after about 4 or 5 days, things started to pick up. So they said that you've got a good chance that you'll take him home. They said, I don't know how much of him you'll take home or in what condition. You know, I think there was a strong possibility of brain damage, which probably is still there to some degree, but I managed to escape most of it, luckily. Unfortunately, due to blood pressure issues, because basically meningitis, what it does is that all of your fluid in your body goes to your brain. And that's what it tries to protect. You know, your body wants to protect the brain. It actually drains fluid from your organs even, because that's the main thing it wants to protect is your brain. So because of that, all the extremities, anything far away from your body starts losing blood pressure. So the doctors try and, fix this by pumping you full of fluid. And I can't remember exactly. I think there was too much fluid or too much pressure in my leg at this point because everything had subsided, but fluid's still there. So they tried to drain it. And unfortunately, that didn't really help. And at this point, my foot's just dying. You know, there's just, I think things are going black. And they're just like, we've got to amputate. So, after I think a day, they decided that they had to amputate. They took the leg off, or took the foot off, about halfway down my lower leg. So I'm a below knee amputee. And then that was that, really. That's how I lost my leg and I was ill. But I think it was quite a lot for my parents to go through, because obviously being 5 years old, I didn't really have a full understanding of what was going on, and I was young enough that luckily I could just get on with life and not think too much about it. But I think that was quite a tough time for my family, my parents especially.
Yeah, I mean, have you spoken to your parents much about that since? I am a mother to a 3-year-old, and I'm sure you know anyway. I mean, it's just every parent's absolute worst nightmare. I mean, it terrifies me more than anything to think that something would happen to my daughter. How did they cope with all of that, and not knowing if they could bring you back from hospital, and then I guess gauging what kind of a version of Johnny they brought home again?
Yeah, I mean, I've spoke to them a few times. My mum, I think, kind of went into protection mode. I think as a parent, they do. You know, she kind of tried to put on a brave face for me, and it wasn't probably until she was back in this stadium here and she saw me. She said that when she saw me cross that line, I think she knew I was okay.
In 2012,
yeah. So I think...
So how many years later was that?
I lost it when I was 5, so I'd have been 98. So, yeah, what's that? 14 years. 14 years later, she had tried to protect me. And I think that she kind of held on to a lot, closed a lot away from her mind, you know, closed that dark space. And I'd moved out a year before 2012. I think she was still kind of holding on to that. She was still worrying about me, as like all parents do. But I think, yeah, she tells me that kind of when she saw me finish it, when she saw me cross that line, she was like, he'll be okay on his own now. Like, he's fine. And I think that's for her when it kind of, she started really dealing with it. So I think she went through a bit of a tough time at that stage. But as well, I think it must have been really tough for my dad, because my mum and dad had split up at this time. They split up a couple of years previous. And my dad was working in Ireland at this stage when he found out I was ill, so he had to fly over. And I think from my side, I was like, that's always got to be so tough, knowing that your child's going through that and you're hours away. You know, you can't do anything about it. You can't see them. So I think that would have been really tough for him as well. So He's a bit more bit more like Milo, a bit more logical. So I think when he saw I was okay, he's a bit better. Obviously, he's still incredibly tougher to go through, and he was always there for me. They were both always there for me. I've got really, really, really lucky that I've kind of got parents, I guess, that kind of drove behind me so well and supported me. But like you say, I think it's just every parent would be very similar.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what my instinct would be to do. And that's, I guess, where the fear of sport probably would come from.
Exactly. And you see it. I've seen it a lot. Being in Paralympic sport, I see parents that do try and wrap their children up in cotton wool, but actually, to be honest with you, I think it's probably the worst thing to do sometimes. You know, it's completely natural and it's the hardest thing to do, which is letting your child go off. Any parent tells you that's hard. You know, when they see their kids leave home, go to university, they always say how hard it is. You know, I'm not a parent, so I can't imagine, but you hear the stories and you see how hard it is. So it must be even more tough to see your child if they've gone through something that you worry even more about. You know, they're even more vulnerable. But I think the best thing to do really is to kind of let them try and get on with it, let them try and create their own lives. And I've been around so many disabled people in my life. The ones that really are independent, the ones that really do get on with things the best, are the ones whose parents have let them, you know, have let them get on with it. And it is tough, you know, and it is hard, but I think sometimes you just have to do it. And, you know, I'd use it as an excuse. You know, I'd be sat at home. My mum would be like, right, Johnny, it's your turn to wash the dishes. And she'd suddenly hear a big bang in the living room. And she's like, what's that? That's Johnny taking his leg off because he doesn't want to do it, you know. So, and then she'd just be like, right, fine. And she'd pull up a chair. She'd go, right, you can kneel on that, you know. So you're not going to get away with this. So, you know, that's the kind of parent that she was. You know, you've got to push them into it. And it's led me into the person I am today. You know, I'd like to sound quite an independent person. And, yeah, I think that's the best thing for kids.
I was going to ask about that, actually, and I mean, I know that five is very young, but anyone who's got experience of kids knows that you've got a fully formed personality by that stage. Did you notice, or did your mum notice, any change in your personality after the illness and after losing your leg? And do you think that that's in any way formed a part of your personality, a part of your character since then?
I'm not too sure, to be honest. I mean, it must have. It has to have. You know, I can't imagine that something like that wouldn't have had quite a big impact. I think for me, I know that when I woke up, obviously, I blamed my mum. So I looked down, and I think that would have been really tough for her. I think I was screaming at her, like, why did you let them do this? But which I do feel incredibly guilty.
Because, of course, you would have gone to sleep not knowing anything and then woken up and all you knew was you were better, but you didn't realise how ill you were and you'd lost half a leg.
Well, yeah, you just look down and all of a sudden I've got one leg and, you know, that would have been tough. But I think luckily there was a psychologist there who'd spoken to my mum and actually told her that what happens in that situation is that the child will blame whoever they're closest to because they know it's a safe place to put it, because they know that regardless of how bad I you know, how upset I am, it's because I'm doing it to somebody that I know will still be there for me when I'm okay. So I think that's the reason that I would have done it. You know, it would have been incredibly tough for her. But you know, I think after a little while, I think we were fine again, and I think I started to get over it. It's a weird, because I don't really remember a lot of that period of time. I think it was probably a lot tougher than I probably remember it. It's probably a lot that my brain has shut off and shut and locked away. I think my mum told me that she knew that I'd be okay was when I woke up after a procedure and I started like reaching for something in the distance, and my mum turned and she saw on the wall that there was like rubber gloves, obviously all the doctor's gloves, and I had like something for rubber gloves when I was like 5 years old. She's like, she couldn't take me anywhere if there was rubber gloves on the wall. I just wanted to have them like and wear them. So she was like, yeah, he'll be okay now. So rubber gloves was when she knew it was all okay.
Because you seem like such a confident and positive, upbeat person. I mean, I met you before 2012 and then even, you know, you were full of confidence before you became known for your talent. Was there ever any stage throughout your childhood, after initially waking up, I guess, where you thought, this isn't fair? Why did this happen to me? Any period where you had to go through a little bit of the darkness?
Oh, 100%. I think a big part of it was probably through puberty. So when I was probably about 13 plus, you know, it'd be days where I'd walk home from school, it'd be very hot in the summer, I'd often get sores on my leg, and you know, it'd be really sore and it'd take me a bit longer to walk home. I'd always push through it, always push through the pain. But you know, you'd sit there and you would, you know, be very upset, I'd be in pain, I'd be hot, I'd be tired, and I would just sit there and I'd question, you know, why is this me? Why am I the one that has to go through this? I think that they were tough times for me, probably. You know, there was probably many days at that period of time, like every probably teenager does, you know, through whatever is going on in their life that will apply to. But yeah, there was probably real tough moments for me then. And my dad would always tell me that, look, when you get older, you will like be okay, and you will sit there and realize that this is just you, and it doesn't matter, you know, like bullying, for example, it doesn't matter what people say. You're going to realize that their opinion really doesn't matter. And he was right, you know, and it is true. It's one of those cliches that kids probably get told, that when you grow up, you aren't going to care as much. It's completely true, you know, because I've grown up now and I've been incredibly lucky in the path that I've been on, and, you know, where we've ended up. But I'm for sure, I think that, you know, it's built me into the person I am today. And tough times, you know, I think they make you stronger at the same time. You know, everything kind of has an equal and opposite effect. And I'd like to say that that's all turned me into the person I am today. And yeah, I guess, like you say, positive. Try and be positive. I try and flip everything. You always try and look for the bright side. Even athletics, for example, you know, every time I get injured, we always look at it and go, right, what can we do? You know, for example, if I've injured my foot and I can't run, okay, but I can do weights. So let's hit this as hard as humanly possible. That's harder than I would be able to if I was running. So you turn it into a positive. You turn it into, right, we're going to come back and we're going to be stronger in this region. So everything you look at, right, what can we actually do to get the best out of this situation? So you try and apply that to everything in life.
So how did you keep the faith or have confidence that you would become an athlete? Because there's the saying, if you see it, you can be it. But there weren't really Paralympic role models, I guess, as you were growing up. It's changed now massively, and that's not just something you've witnessed. You've helped forge that for the generation to come. But when you were little, there was no Johnny Peacock. There was no Alan Oliveira. How did you keep thinking, yeah, that's a future that's viable for me?
Yeah. I don't know. I guess I have my own sporting icons, you know. Obviously, David Beckham was huge for me when I was growing up. I was absolutely mad about him. So that was just sport icon in general. I didn't really differentiate it, you know, between, I guess, able and disabled. You know, throughout my whole school, everything I did was able-bodied. I never really turned my attention to disability sport until I reached about 15, 16 and thought to myself, right, I am reasonably good at able-bodied sport. I wonder how good I would actually be in disabled sport, because I'd heard about the Paralympics. I didn't even think I watched much of 2008 Paralympics. I didn't think I watched much of 2008 Olympics. I remember seeing Usain Bolt. Mm-hmm. That's about it. I think that was pretty cool. That's probably got me a little bit inspired into the sprinting. And obviously at that stage as well, as I was starting sport, we were seeing Oscar Pistorius breaking his way onto the Golden League circuits at the time, running in able-bodied races. So I remember watching those on my TV in my room. Obviously some guy with blades running around a track with able-bodied people beating some. So I think that probably maybe would have inspired me and would have made me thought that's definitely possible, and that's something that I want to be a part of.
Yeah, I think the advent of blades must have made a big difference, I guess, in terms of it being cool and something that you might think is possible, I guess, in terms of making you run faster as well.
Yeah, I think blades, yeah, I think they do make everything a little bit cooler. You know, they look cool. I like them. I think that they add a little bit of something extra. And yeah, I think for me as well, though, like, I always wanted a blade. When I started sport, I was like, oh, I need to get a blade. And I remember this physio was telling me, you don't need one. He's like, you don't need one yet. And it's completely true. You know, I ran, I started my first year and a half on my standard day leg, what I'm wearing now. You know, I ran, took my PB down from, I think, 13.2 to 12.2, just in my standard day leg. And then got a blade, trained on it for, I think, 6 months, and I ran 11.8. And actually, if you track progression in terms of months and time taken down, the blade didn't actually make a huge amount of difference. It wouldn't have really spiked that curve. I think it really helps as you get down to the last kind of 20%. There's no way I'm going to be able to run 10.6 on this leg right now, because it just stops all momentum. It's like, I don't know how to explain it. It's just when you run, obviously you've got your Achilles, your calf, everything kind of gives you a pop, gives you a drive. When I land on my leg, everything just stops. Mm. So any momentum that I've gained literally gets killed in one step. And that's why blades are great, because they allow that momentum to flow. They allow you to progress, and they allow it to just keep building and building and building. So it definitely helped my top end, you know. But yeah, I always try and say to kids, because you see them now, they're like, I need a blade. And it's the same. You don't need it yet. Just keep running. And then if you can, and if you're lucky enough to get a blade, obviously, yeah, take it. And I was lucky enough at a certain age, my coach at the time had at a competition had spoken to the manufacturer that made blades. They agreed to let me try one. So, yeah, I was very lucky. But you don't need a blade, but it definitely helps and looks a bit better.
Yeah, it definitely looks cool. But is it not quite difficult for you having one human leg and one blade? How do you balance that? Because the power must be completely different. The spring must be completely different. I mean, how does that work?
Yeah, for sure. I think that, you know, it's one of those things that if you have two able-bodied or two blades, it's almost better. You try to have two because you're symmetrical. But that's just something that we work on in training. You know, we just strive for symmetry. You know, we look at stride length. We try and obviously make sure that they match. Force output, you're basically just trying to be as symmetrical as possible, because what you tend to find as well in looking at testing is that you will always adapt. So if you can get a blade that has, that's really stiff, and that if you hit it hard enough will give you a good step length, a really long step length, then my able body leg to my blade will be a lot shorter. It will adapt to it. And what you tend to see is that over two steps it's always the same distance. It's just sometimes it looks different, and what you want is for those two steps to be equal. So, for example, let's say two steps are 4 meters. You want each of those two each step to be 2 meters. But for example, if you have a really stiff blade, you might end up with the blade to able-bodied leg step being 2.5 meters. But that means that the able-body to blade step will probably change to 1.5 meters. So it'll always adapt. The body is incredible. I think what you realize is that when you've got one of each, is that the body is incredible. The body does so much more than we realize, and it will adapt, and it just gets used to things. And the neuromuscular system is incredibly intelligent, and it will find a way to cheat. I think that's what you find as well, is that anyone who goes to sports and does PT and stuff, the body will always try and cheat away, and they'll always tell you that's not the correct way to hold this ab, this plank or something like that, because your body's just cheating, finding an easier method for it. So we're very lucky, I think, all of us, to have very, very clever systems that we don't even realise the full capabilities of.
So I want to talk about your big experience here in the stadium of which we're sitting in the belly. London 2012, it is a period that now lives in a sort of a rosy corner of my memory. You know, I just look back on it so amazingly fondly, and just the joy that those few weeks of sport gave to the whole nation and beyond was just something that was wonderful to behold. And I constantly wonder what it must have been like for any of the athletes in the middle of all of that, putting a GB best on, and then of course, as you did, winning gold. How was that, the whole experience of 2012?
It was a bit strange. Yeah, I think I definitely remember watching the Olympics, because obviously Paralympics was after, so I was still training at this point in Lee Valley, a few miles up the road from where we are. And I remember there was a TV, and we used to get to watch all of the Olympics whilst we were training, and it was just great motivation. And yeah, everyone was doing so well. There was just a great positive vibe going around the place. People were being friendly in London. You know, it was just a really strange time.
It was very odd.
No one really quite knew what was going on. The sun was shining. It wasn't raining. Basically, very similar to the last few weeks we've really had with the England World Cup team up until last week. Yeah, it was a very similar situation going on. And yeah, that was just, it was a really cool time, I think. And then when you turn up to the Paralympics, obviously you get kind of put into the bubble, and all of the Olympic guys would have probably been the same. You know, you just get kind of dropped into a bubble where you don't really realize what's going on. You just focused on what you have to focus on, which was, for me, my race. So everything I was doing was just focused on that. You know, I was thinking about the next training session. I was thinking about what I had to eat, what supplements I needed to take, how much sleep I needed to get. You're just thinking about all these things, and you're not really realizing what's going on around you. And I remember actually when I was training, someone managed to get me a ticket to the Olympics, just so I thought, oh, I'll just go down, have a sit in the stadium, just to get kind of feel the energy
for the athletics.
Yeah, for the athletics. I just thought I'll feel the energy in the place. And I remember it was just electric. It was so loud, it was incredible. I thought to myself, if it's just 1/10 as good as this, as loud as this for the Paralympics, I'll be really happy.
Did you not find that intimidating, or did you get an excitement from it? I mean, to go there a few weeks before your own competition, I think must have been terrifying.
It's just exciting. No, it was just really exciting. You know, I think for me it was trying to take it as a great experience. You know, and I think it was an incredible experience, and it was incredibly lucky as well to have my first Paralympics as a home Paralympics. You know, not many people get to compete in the pinnacle of their sport at home. So we were incredibly lucky to get given that opportunity. So I just tried to enjoy it. Yeah, and coming and watching watching the athletics. I think I saw some of the 100 meter heats. So it was just really, really cool. And it was really loud. And obviously, if we look back to Beijing Paralympics, the stadiums were full, but I don't think the energy was quite there, and it wasn't quite loud. So when we came in and we saw day one Paralympics, 80,000 people piled into the stadium, and the noise that they produced, it was absolutely insane. And not one of us would have pictured that happening. I don't think anyone sitting at home looking at Paralympics in the past would have ever imagined that 2012 would have been that successful. And it was definitely, for me, where the Paralympics changed. And that was probably in the first 10 minutes of the first session in this stadium, in the athletic stadium, where it just becomes so loud. And yeah, I think every athlete will always be incredibly grateful to the British public, because every time that they come back here for any event, they're just the same. So it still hasn't quite gone.
Because the atmosphere in the stadium for the Paralympics was, and indeed in all the venues that I went to, was at least as electric as for the Olympics. And I was so blown away by that. As an athlete standing, crouching on the start line, how did that feel? Because you can't have experienced anything like that before as an athlete.
No, not at all. Yeah, I think the most that I'd ever competed in before that was about 5,000 in Manchester.
Compared to 80,000.
Yeah, so quite different and quite a different noise level. But again, it's strange. You just kind of go into work mode. You know, like I guess everyone does in their own way. You know, I just flick that switch where you just go work mode, and it was just focus. You know, I'm thinking about the job that I've got to do, and you just take it all in. I remember we had a talk from Christina Hurigu before we came up. We were in a holding
the 400 meter runner,
the 400 meter gold medalist, Olympic gold medalist, yeah, an incredible legend of the sport. And she came and she talked to us in Portugal in a holding camp just before, and she said, people will tell you what it's like, people will tell you what the Olympics is like, what the Paralympics is like, what World Championships is like, and she goes, but it's going to be different for you. She goes, so don't expect anything. She's like, expect the unexpected and just let it happen. Have your own experience. And I remember I just let that happen. And that, I think that was the best advice that I've ever been given. And it's something that I always try and tell anybody that's about to start sport. And it is, have your own experience. Don't expect anything. Because the second you expect anything, when that goes slightly differently, you panic. So if you go into the stadium expecting it to be really quiet and it's really loud, you know, you're kind of thrown off your game. So you just go into there with an open mind and just say, whatever happens, it's going to happen, and enjoy it. So we did. We just every athlete seemed to do that. Every athlete that came back to the village, you know, I think I was competing on day 5 or 6, so I had to wait quite a while. And all the athletes are coming back, oh, it was the best day of my life. It was just incredible. The crowd are amazing. Not one person that I spoke to was ever scared. Because I don't know what it was. Yeah, everyone was just, I think they felt supported. Everyone felt supported by the athletes, not intimidated. So it was an incredible energy that was created here.
Talk us through your finals then. What do you remember? What are the standout bits?
For me, I remember warming up for the final. And I felt good. You know, I knew I was in good shape. I knew that I was the fastest in the field. I knew that it was possible that other people could have the best race of their life and produce better times. And I was ready for that, but I felt good. You know, I think one thing that I've probably not mentioned so far as well is that I was given the best opportunity and the best thing that's ever happened to me, which was I was given to Dan Paff as a sprints coach in 2012, who was an American coach that had been brought over by British Athletics to basically coach a few athletes. He coached Greg Rutherford, Steve Lewis, Goldie Sayers, who all produced British records in that year as well, by the way, as well as an Olympic champion, obviously, Greg Rutherford. But this is a god of all things coaching. You know, you speak to any coach about him, he's pretty much at the top of that pyramid. Dan Paff, he is incredible. So when I was given the opportunity to work with him in that 2012 year, that was the best thing that's ever happened to me, because he taught me so much about sprinting. He taught me more in probably 3 months than I'd learned in my entire sporting career. You know, even now, I still haven't learned as much that I probably learned in 3 months with him. He was just an absolute book of knowledge. You know, you could ask him a question and he'd give you 50 answers. You know, he was an incredible person, and he taught me so much, and he gave me an incredible program, and he turned me into the athlete that I was. He took me from somebody that was slowly progressing, you know, 2-3 tenths at a time, you know, to somebody that ran 11:47 coming into him and left him running 10:85, you know, so 6 tenths, which is ridiculous. And so when I knew that, standing in the warm-up area, about to head out, that I've got this coach with me, it just made me confident. You know, I was just confident. And I remember Steve Lewis told me that. He said, you stand on that start line knowing that you are the best prepared out of anyone there. He said, not one person in that lineup is going to have the setup that you have. Not one person is going to have the coaching, the coach that you have. And you remember that. You're standing there and you it just fills you with confidence. So I think I started the race quite confident. Yeah, I was standing there and I felt happy. I felt excited and I felt prepared. And the race itself, I don't really remember until about 70 meters. Yeah, I kind of just, it was all a blur. You just do things off of instinct up to about 60-70 meters, and then I remember realizing that I was in the front, that I was leading the race. I think I needed a change of underpants at that stage because I just absolutely was terrified. I just thought,
why terrified?
Because the thing is in sprinting as well, you often see double amputees are really good in the last straight, so you're always worried as a single that a double amputee is just going to come out of nowhere and just overtake you. So I kind of just expected that to happen. You know, I think the last 2-3 world championships and races leading into this had been won by a dip, so I just expected somebody to come flying out of nowhere, and then I just tensed up and I probably did the ugliest last 20 meters than I've ever done in my life, but somehow I managed to hold on. And yeah, it was just an absolute elation and a feeling that it just undescribable. Yeah, when I crossed that line, it was insane. Then obviously we had London 2017 here as well, which was just as good. I remember finishing my heat, actually sat where we are right now, having a smoothie to try and recover, because I had, I think, 3 hours between the heat and the final, which wasn't a nice smoothie. It was pretty gross, but it refueled me with what I needed to. So yeah, yes, I've had some incredible memories here, and I've had a very, very lucky path that I've been given to some great people that have looked after me and that have set me straight. I think that none of what I've achieved would have ever been possible had it not been for me moving to Danpath in 2012, and then everything everything after that, really.
It's incredible that you say about being lucky. You know, whenever people, if you're going to look at your start in life and going through something that's so traumatic as losing a leg, does it make you look on all of that a little bit differently, I guess? Is it too silly a question to ask whether it makes you almost, maybe not grateful for what you went through, but appreciative at least of the fact that that's part of what got you here?
Oh, for sure. You know, I think the kind of, I want to make an experiment in my head. You know, you think, like, how fast would I run with two legs? You know, there's always that question, you know, the technical side. It's like, because I used to speak to Dan about this, and he'd, you know, sort of speak a few things about, like, force output, elasticity and stuff like this, and because he did say that my left leg was really elastic. So he thought I would probably be run quite quick. So I always sit there and think, oh, well, how fast would I run, you know, with two legs? You know, would I just be what I am now, or would I be faster, you know, or what? So there's that. But, yeah, obviously, it's not
would that matter?
Things.
Would that matter? Yeah. Would you rather be an Olympic champion than a Paralympic champion?
I don't know. You know, the thing is, this is what I mean. Like, the life that I've got right now, the opportunities that I've got, the experiences that I've had, wouldn't have been possible probably had it not been for me losing a leg at 5 years old. So I always sit there, and I think the question is, people always ask me, like, oh, would you have your leg back and stuff like that? And I think for me, my answer used to be 100%, and I think now it's, well, let me have this life until I'm about 30 or 40, and then give me my leg after that, because that's when the problems will probably start happening anyway. So, yeah, I probably wouldn't change it, to be honest with you. It would be a very tricky decision to make, but I don't think I would change it, because it's given me the life that I've led. And, you know, I've met my girlfriend through this scene as well. You know, I've been with her for 6 years now. You know, I met her on the circuit too. So I've been given a great life because of what's happened to me. And, you know, my mum always used to say, obviously everything happens for a reason, you know, that old cliche saying, but it's definitely given me a life that I would never have expected to happen. And yeah, hopefully through that journey, we've been able to kind of push the Paralympics up a bit, and yeah, kind of give kids that were in my position when I was 5, something to maybe strive for, something to maybe look at and say, I'm not so different after all.
Because not many athletes, never mind Paralympic athletes, go on to cross over into the public consciousness, really, in the way that you have. And, you know, you've had success on Strictly Come Dancing, or Dancing with the Stars, as people might know it. Yeah. You success, you were on it. You danced well. I thought you were good. And you know, you build up a good fan base from that as well, yeah. You know. You don't seem to think it went quite that well.
No, do you know what? Yeah, I've been so lucky. And again, these are opportunities that were so great. And when the Strictly Come Dancing thing came around, for example, I sat there. I'm not the best dancer. I am the last person to get up on that dance floor. I have to be to the point where I know I won't remember it the next day. I was like, right, I can go embarrass myself now because I won't remember it tomorrow anyway, so it's fine. And when it came around, I was like, oh.
And yet you said yes.
Well, this is it. For me, it was a case of that, obviously, disabled people had taken part in series in other countries and celebrity specials and things like that, but nobody had ever actually been part of the UK main show. And all I thought is, what I want to do is I want to go out there and I want to show them what's possible. You know, I might not do it the prettiest or to the best of my ability or to the best act, you know, that they always want, but I'll be able to show them what's possible, you know, and that was for me. And I wanted to put my blade on one day, you know, and do a jive and show people that it can be cool and it can be fun and that, you know, we can make these legs look a bit cooler, even on the dance floor, and kids can see that. And, you know, I saw able-bodied kids wanting blades and trying to like pretend, and it was awesome. But then I also wanted to go and do a ballroom dance and wear a coat and tails and a pair of trousers and have people who perhaps didn't know me and perhaps were flicking through the channels say, oh, there's a disabled person in here. Which one is it? Yeah. And I remember actually, I think it was after, I can't remember which dance it was, after one of our dance, we came up and Anton, who obviously king of Strictly Come Dancing, said to Oti, he stopped Tony, said, you've done a great job. He goes, I was looking down there, and obviously I was wearing trousers at this point. He goes, I could not tell for the life of me which leg was the disabled one. He goes, and this is somebody that is a dancer, you know, and he was looking at the feet and he could not figure out which foot was which. And that was what I wanted to take away from it. And I remember actually it got to the point which was, you probably won't want to say, but there was a few comments made towards the end as obviously votes weren't getting high, that if I wanted votes to go up, you know, for example, when my blade came out, votes went up and things like that. So people were like, oh, you know, you could go further. And I was like, no, you know, for me, it was a case of I would rather go because my dancing ability was not as good as everyone else's. I don't want to be in the final because, everyone's going, oh, he's got a great leg, how good's he doing? I want him to go and look at me as an individual and go, you know what, he's not the best dancer, we should not be voting for him. And I want them to forget, and I want them to forget of me as just a disabled person and see me as just another person, because that's what I wanted to achieve. I wanted to achieve finishing Strictly with the fact of people seeing that's possible. You know, I had a doctor question me when I had my physical for it, going, just as I was leaving, go, oh, by the way, I forgot to ask, he goes, are you going to be okay with lifts, you know? And I was like, what do you mean? He's like, well, you know, you're going to have to might have to pick a dancer up. He goes, is that going to be okay? And my response was, well, I said, when I do strength training in the gym, I said, I have to put 200 kilos on my back and step onto a box single-legged. I said, so is that okay? I was, oh, yeah, you'll be fine. So it's changing that perception. It's people perceive that just because you're disabled, oh, you can't do that, you can't. It's completely false. And it's just going out. I just wanted to go out there, maybe not do it pretty, but at least show them this is how it can be done. And then hopefully next year or in a couple of years, they'll get somebody on there who can actually dance and they'll show you how it's done properly, not just how it's done. So yeah, it was great fun though. And Oti was an incredible teacher, and definitely I think everything was down to her. Incredible choreographer, incredible teacher. Bit tough though.
Well, I loved it. I thought you were brilliant. You have smashed records, won medals, broken down barriers, changed perceptions. What's next, Johnny?
I don't know. You know, I think obviously this year has been really cool. You know, we took this decision a while ago where obviously 2018, we wanted to take a little bit down because of 2016, 2017 World Championships. We thought a couple big years, let's rest after it. And we've had a really cool year. We've done some really, really fun stuff. And being part of the Athletics World Cup with Sky has been incredible. And these are all opportunities that I wouldn't have really probably had before. And they've been great fun. But winter will start soon and the athletic season will start again. So we have World Championships next year. We have Tokyo 2020. You know, I still have got more aspirations to go and do more in sport. So that's next. After that, I don't know. You know, I live my life quite kind of each bridge as you come to it. So we'll see. I just want to be happy. You know, that's for me. And I think that you see all these things. You see timelines, as for example, jobs, how long you do that. You just got to do something you're happy doing, you know, regardless of what it means. And for me, I'm really happy at the moment. I'm really happy with what I do. So hopefully in 10 years' time, I'll still be doing something that I'm happy with and that I love.
It's that pursuit of happiness over all else that seems to be the defining characteristic of Johnny Peacock. Not the medals, not any kind of wider fame, but happiness as a goal in itself. Now, obviously, if it were that easy, we'd all be able to simply be happy. But I do think we're often so busy chasing dreams that we think others will value rather than what journey suits us best, that we can lose sight of what gives us meaning. And if that happens to be finding a way to being the best in the world, well, then it's easy for others to identify why you're happy. But I suspect it's that individual journey more than anything else that maybe really matters, or at least it seems to be the case for Johnny Peacock. Well, a huge thank you to Jonathan Rowe for editing this episode of When Orla Met. If you have any thoughts on any of the episodes you've heard so far, then you can get in touch via email, orla@whenorlamet.com, or on Twitter, find me at @whenorlamet, and you can follow me on Instagram under the same handle. If you like what you hear, do leave me a review on iTunes, and don't forget to not miss out on any of the fascinating chats still to come. Please do subscribe to When Orla Met.